Hello, this is Jerry, Andy's brother Julian. And,
hello.
Hello. So it's a bit between conspiracy and consensus podcast. We haven't done one for a while, have we? We haven't done one since November. And I don't know. I don't know I personally, I can't speak for you, but I've not really been in the mood, really. I'm just, sometimes all the arguing and the bickering and the mudslinging just gets a bit too much, doesn't it, sometimes? And I think that combined with being locked down as well, you know, sometimes it's a battle just to try and keep sane, isn't it? And
yeah. Well, especially I think for us, more than like lots of other countries, because we were locked down, weren't we, in the UK?
Yeah.
And the kids didn't go to school, so we had to do homeschooling every day. And it's just like, it just takes up every waking moment, doesn't it? Especially with me, I've got an 11-year-old and 11-year-old autistic kid and a 6-year-old, and it's like having them around 24 hours a day. It's a bit exhausting.
Yeah.
And there's an element of, I suppose, that whole kind of after the election and the madness in January, the Capitol siege, it was all getting a bit weird, wasn't it? And it's, I don't know, there's elements of kind of just shutting off from it once in a while as well.
Well, I think it's the whole thing is toxic, isn't it? The whole atmosphere was toxic. I still think it is, but and I think that level of toxicity when the temperature's constantly being turned up, it's not a comfortable atmosphere, and you do think that things could explode at time to time. And sometimes, look, we're no big shakes as a podcast, you know, a few hundred listeners or whatever it is. But I don't particularly want to add to the toxicity. And that's the difficulty, because I don't want to contribute. I'm not narcissistic enough to believe that whatever we say on this little thing has an effect in the outside world. But I don't want to contribute to ugliness. I was thinking about it the other day. I don't want to antagonise people. So why do I talk about things sometimes? But I think, if I see the world changing in front of my eyes, and I quite like the world that I live in, and I see it changing in a way that's going to diminish it, make it uglier and make it a less good and nice place for my children to grow up in, I think I'm well within my rights to say I think that's bollocks. So, I think there is so much pressure to get people just to shut up and accept what's going on. And it seems that so many people want to advance their argument by closing down opposing argument. I have a natural feeling to say up yours. So, yeah, you know, sometimes I want to talk, other times I don't. And then I was thinking, well, what is there to talk about? And it's not that there isn't anything to talk about. There's just too much to talk about. So you don't know what to pin it on. Do you know what I mean? It's like, where the bloody hell do you start?
I know, right? You got the COVID. Like, it's crazy, isn't it, that we're living through such a historic moment. No other time have we ever kind of shut down the world's economy to such an extent, and furloughed people and paid for people to be sitting at home and not send kids to school for months on end, and closed churches and just like such extreme measures. And you think, well, that's the biggest story. But I was thinking a year ago today, the stock market's like plunged, and they lost about, didn't they lose like 15% a day or something? Like, biggest story in the world. And yet, so often, it's just, well, maybe because we've had a year of it, you want to move on to something else, but so often it's a little side story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Other craziness is going on. Oh, it's more than enough to talk about.
Well, I think COVID, I mean, what we're going to talk about. I was thinking, it reminds me of that song years ago. It's a little cultural reference. They've got a very narrow group of people that would get it. It was an eye level song. It was an old Brit funk band that had that minefield, and it was a "Let's Dance Together in a Minefield." And it's sort of like, it feels like that. I can't stop singing that, because every subject is pretty dangerous. You've got Meghan and Harry, you've got Black Lives Matter or whatever it is, you've got Sarah Everard, you know, the girl got murdered last week. In an environment where if you put a foot wrong, you could be in trouble. And so you want to speak about the subjects. But I think the whole lockdown thing has kind of magnified the intensity of it all, wasn't it? Because we haven't got other things. Yeah. To, I noticed that I've been working over the last couple of weeks. I've been going out to work. It's not a great deal of work out there, but just the fact that I'm going out to work means that I'm on social media much less. I mean, I'll get halfway through the day and realise I haven't even scanned Twitter. And I think that's really healthy.
It's a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a year, isn't
it? COVID stuff going in a good direction, isn't it?
What's that?
Here, hopefully, fingers crossed, we've both been vaccinated.
Yeah, we're both sheeple.
Yeah.
We're both sheeple now. So, yeah, both been vaccinated.
Well, the first one, at least.
Well, the first one, yeah. So hopefully, look, it's sometimes when you talk about opening up in the summer and everyone booking tickets for these events and the festival up the road, there's another one in September just up the road from me, a big dance festival, God knows how many people. And it just seems so alien just to be back to normal in such a short period of time, doesn't it? Sometimes it feels like it's a bit too good to be true.
Well, it might well be. Look, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I was telling a couple of mates a while ago, a couple of months ago, place you got to watch somewhere like Israel, because it's a real canary in the coal mine, and I think we're getting to that level now as well, because by the number of vaccines we've given out, and I think now we've kind of administered about 50% of the population with like one dose, near enough 48%, something like that. But when you take out the equation all the kids that probably aren't going to get it or don't need it, it's a serious chunk of the adult population, and it's clear that the numbers of cases and deaths are dropping like a stone. They have been doing it in Israel for months now, and I think last time I looked, they were down to like kind of low double figure deaths every day, like 20s, teens, and down to like single digits. And we're going that direction, but my concern is that that's just a blip, because you never really know. I think a lot of Europe wasn't getting vaccinated, and they were heading in the same direction as us. Now they've taken a different turn. You just don't know, do you? It's always kind of too, with something like COVID, it's always too early to talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, because I think, and I'm not a virologist, all these new words that none of us ever knew, none of us even knew a year ago, viral load, neurologist, or virologist or whatever, but I think what I was hearing today, which makes sense, that even if we are able to vaccinate us, ourselves, if it runs rife in the rest of the world, it's going to mutate into different variants that could still affect us, which is why there still needs to be caution, doesn't there? I mean, some arguments are saying, well, if we're all vaccinated, what, you know, there is that conspiracy theory where people suspect for some reason that the government are happy to close us all down, lock us all in our houses and let the economy go to shit for some reason. I don't, you know, just because of some sort of like power control issue, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So I understand the argument, well, look, if the bulk of us are vaccinated, why can't we go back to normal? And I suppose that reason makes sense. If everyone goes back to normal and it does mutate and means something mutate and evolve into something that the current vaccines can't protect us from, there is that danger. So, look, I get it. You just got to tiptoe slowly, don't you? And baby steps, bit by bit, and hopefully we can get back to some sort of normality, I think. Hopefully.
Yeah.
And then pick up the pieces, because I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, there's going to be a lot of issues afterwards, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Long COVID, people that are going to be affected by it psychologically as well. You know, I think, it's hard, isn't it? Because with us, you know, I've been all right. Well, saying I've been all right, I've struggled, to be honest, especially this winter. It's been pretty tough. It's been pretty tough with the homeschooling and not being able to meet up with people. And, you know, sometimes you're in a pressure cooker with people that you'll kind of want to explode once now and again. But, you know, if you do, it kind of toxifies the environment for everybody else. You kind of got to learn to manage that. And but I'm really aware that we're the lucky ones. You know, imagine them, the council flats with six people in, you know, and you've got four kids.
Because I'm the same. We've never done so much shouting when we had the kids at home. It's exhausting. But I'm well aware that, like, we're so lucky. I'm like we live in a country where I get 80% of my wage just to sit around and teach my kids.
Yeah.
And we've got a decent house, a big house, lots of open space, parks across the road. It's amazing. There's so many upsides to it, but it's still a struggle, and I agree.
Of course, yeah.
God knows what it's like. Some poor buggers who are like single parent families, or and the one parent that is there has to go to work.
Yeah.
And yeah, God knows what the kids are up to, and it must be awful for a lot of people.
Yeah, I've tried. You know what?
That's living in a country.
Yeah.
That's coping with that element of it really well. I mean,
yeah.
The mere fact that we're getting furloughed is unbelievable, really, in the grand scheme of things. When you look around the world, it's so, like, you just get on with it. You don't get anything if you don't work.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, it's kind of weird because I've struggled. My wife works full-time upstairs. I don't see much of her. So I've having to look after and teach my daughter. And also we got a puppy, didn't we, at the same time. So I never realised that having a puppy was so much hard work. And I'm thinking, why didn't anyone tell me? Why? Why? The amount of times I'm thinking I've made the biggest mistake in my life. It's been so hard. But so having a puppy was hard. Homeschooling is hard. And it was the first time I ever understood the saying, it's bigger than the sum of its parts. So the hard work of the puppy and the hard work of homeschooling are both really hard. But if you add them both together, it's significantly harder than just putting the two of them together, because they both hinder each other. The puppy hinders the homeschooling, and the homeschooling hinders the ability to look after the puppy. And it was a bloody nightmare. And the thing is, it was all computer systems on having to, after Christmas, you have to navigate Microsoft Teams, which I've never done before. So the person that's upstairs doing all the work, bringing in the money, is also the person that has to solve every problem down here. So you feel like, you go from feeling useless, or I feel useless on a good day, to burdensome on a bad day. And it's not healthy to feel like a burden. You know, it really isn't. Especially as a bloke, you know, you kind of want to be the man running stuff. You know, we instinctively built in there. And you start to feel like you're a burden. It's quite worrying, because, look, I'm not like this. But if you start to feel like you're a burden, the next part of that is, if I wasn't here, it'd be much easier for everyone. Do you know what I mean? You've got to think, hold on, that's nonsense, because you take me away, the same person working then has to do the homeschooling to look after the puppy and the cooking and stuff. So logically, you know the answers, but when your emotions go wobble, you know what it's like. When emotions take over, logic goes out the window. So anyway, but spring's coming, the sun's shining, puppy's less of a burden, kids are back at school, and hopefully things will be all right soonish.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's definitely going the right direction at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And there's still bickering, isn't there? But I think most people are on board. It's quite nice to be, I think it's quite, you wonder, is it nice that we're part of a country that seems to be the most willing to get vaccinated? It seems like a lot of Europe, there's a lot of like conspiracy, higher levels of mistrust and conspiracy thinking, isn't there? Because well, it seems to be, especially with the AstraZeneca vaccine. You know, you've got Macron and
Putin. That side of it, I don't know. I think, yeah, but that side of it was just instigated from the government, wasn't
yeah,
it? Their governments, as in, I think it was kind of talked down right from the start, wasn't
yeah,
it? I don't know whether that's
politics, or what, yeah. And that was my issue. Imagine if Trump had done that. Do you know what I mean? Everyone would be going mad, wouldn't they? Anti-vax, vaccine denier, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Macron does it. Oh, it's all right, you know. And that's the thing. It's just that people look at things differently depending on who does it. But I think it's awful, because there's stories all around Europe where people are going in to get vaccine and finding out it's the AstraZeneca vaccine, and they're turning away. It's not that they've got a choice of another one. They're walking out without it. Even medical workers. It's strange, though, isn't it? Because I was thinking, even medical workers, even something like, I think a large proportion of people that work in, like medical workers or care home workers, weren't taking it either. I think something like 60-70% in Northern England and places like that. And it's kind of really kind of, there is mistrust in certain communities, isn't there? You know, there's a big difference in different communities on who's willing to accept it or not. So I think there's cultural issues of, at play as well.
I did hear like figures of about 30-40% in America like about a month ago. I hadn't heard anything from here, but I was speaking to a friend of mine who wife works in the healthcare system in the NHS here, and but he was saying that she'd refused it twice.
Yeah.
But it's just one anecdotal story. But I've heard figures in the UK.
I read an article that I think said just in certain parts of Yorkshire, I think. So it wasn't a national thing, but I think workers from a white background were taken at something like 73%, and a non-white background was something down in the 30s. So a big difference. Do you know what I mean? Not a minimal difference. Big differences.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons, it's hard, isn't it? Because everyone's getting their own little WhatsApp groups, and you never know. You just don't know what little environments people are in and things, do you? So
yeah, and also we kind of get lost in. You know, especially again, going back to what we were saying about being in a lockdown situation, you don't talk with people face to face, do you?
No.
And you get lost in your own little bubble of whatever you're looking at on the internet, and it's interesting that you think that I was concerned about 2 months ago when the vaccine started rolling out that there'd be a big percentage of people that wouldn't want to take it. And there are stories, like I mentioned, up to 30%. But I think as time goes on, and 6 months down the line, 3 months down the line, people slowly start to see that there aren't any issues with it, at least in the short term. I think the numbers will probably change. I think a lot of people, there's a lot of people who will say they don't want to take it, but when they're faced with it, they will, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think so. I think most people will. Mind you, I don't know. I've not really been on Facebook much. I think I might have muted certain types of people that used to get under my skin, I suppose. So I don't see much of the stuff that irritates me. And that's a difficult one, isn't it? Because sometimes you want to see what people are saying and what other people think. You know, I think that's quite important if you kind of want to know what's going on. But it's a difficult one because if by doing that you find your mood being affected by it all, it's a toughie, isn't it? It's a tough one, isn't it? What do you do? It's like that old philosopher. Yeah. I can't remember who it was. I think it was someone was on a ship once, but back in the days when they used to transport farmyard animals and stuff. But it was an intelligent philosopher that was on a ship, and the ship was in a storm. And he was looking at the pigs in the corner without a care in the world, but the humans were absolutely pooping themselves, worrying that the ship would sink. And he was wondering whether or not it's better to be a human with consciousness and a level of intellect that also saw danger, or would it be better to be a dumb animal who was oblivious to the danger and go through life without a worry in the world, just eating and shitting and shagging. And it's, would you want to be in a world without that consciousness and the good and the bad that goes with it? Or would you want to be a dumb animal? I think today we know that pigs are quite intelligent and stuff. But so yeah, before I get jumped on for being an ignoramus when it comes to animal intelligence, the point is it better to be ignorant and happy or conscious and driven mad? And I think we've all got to get that balance right, don't we? We all know ourselves, and we all got to kind of do what keeps us sane, I think. Because you can get wrapped up in it all, can't you?
Some people lose themselves in it, don't they? It becomes their world. Well, I see it as well, kind of like, it's strange, like certain people that I follow on Instagram and stuff, and you just, every now and again, I'll kind of peep in, and it's almost like get a little peephole into their lives. Just going on about the same old stuff, the same old gripes, the same old. It's like, fucking, it must be a struggle to be in that world. But then, you know, you're only getting a little snapshot of their life, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's the problem with social media. That whether it's just the moans and groans and whinging, or it's just the kind of, look at me, I'm glamorous, standing on a beach in Dubai, you know?
Yeah.
You're only ever seeing a snippet. And none of it's real.
Well, we're all people at different levels as well. Because I was thinking that if you know people, right, and then you see them post on Facebook, and you just think, hold on, that's not you. I know you. I've known you for 40-odd years. This is a you that you're trying to put out to the world. But I know when I talk to you, this isn't you. And then I was thinking, well, if you look at my Twitter is very different to my Facebook. It's very different to my Instagram. Because Facebook, I used to be quite political. I'm not. I'm hardly ever on it now. I think Twitter, probably a lot of retweeting stuff that gets up. So it's a lot more political, Twitter is. But Instagram is politics free, in my opinion. It should be. It's where everyone who got fed up with the politics on Facebook have shifted over to Instagram, because it's just a bit of light fun, light shallow fun. And I was thinking that so many of us are different people to different people. I'm a different person to my children, to the person that I am to my wife, to the person that I am when I go out with my friends. You know, if the me that went out with the boys tried to bring that person to home and be like that with my wife, I'd get a short shrift instantly, you know. So we are all different people. I think what we're struggling with as people, as a society, especially in the West, I can't speak for other parts of the world, but definitely America and England, I think with the loss of religion, families are all over the place. There is a discouragement to be proud in who you are as a nation, you know, especially as white English people. I think there is anything English is kind of brings a bit of a frown to sort of, you know, a raised eyebrow and stuff. So I think there is a massive gap in meaning and purpose and why we're here. You know, religion used to give all those answers, didn't it? But you know, it used to give answers to the unknown questions. And now that's all, you know, going out the window, especially with kind of, not so much America, because I think America's still got a religion issue, but it's definitely shrinking. But in this country, it's only minority communities, I think, that are kind of still big on religion. So I think there's a big gap in meaning and purpose. And I've felt it before when Twitter first started, and like they're on cab driver Twitter or different kind of groups of Twitter, you thought, I want to be one of them warriors. I want to get loads of followers. I want to be one of them people in the fight. It didn't last long, because after a while I got bored of it really quickly and just thought, God, this is so ridiculous, so meaningless and shallow. But you see people that do go 100 miles into it, and it become, if that is a replacement, that becomes their purpose, that becomes their meaning, you know. And I think you can that is a bit of an answer to everything. That is an answer to racism. That is an answer to the alt-right. That is an answer to Black Lives Matter type activism. That, you know, I'm not comparing that to jihadism. I'm not saying that they're the same thing. But I think everyone's looking for a family, kind of, aren't they? So if you can get, you know, whether, you know, the incels and stuff, people that never had any luck with women. You know, years ago, if you had no luck with the opposite sex, you just kind of functioned in the world. Now, within a few clicks of a button on a computer, you're in a totally whole different community that's blocked out everybody else. You're not getting a balance of opinion, and all you're getting is your warped views magnified and justified. And then all of a sudden, people get radicalized. I think that's the same with Islamism, racism, all sorts of stuff. And then that becomes your meaning. That you know, and like religion, you can't. You're not once you've got faith in it, you're not getting anyone questioning you. You're not willing to listen to people who might try and pull you away from that. Same with mass shooters. I think a lot of that stuff, they've gone down certain rabbit holes, And I think what's worrying, I heard on Twitter, something to do with Twitter the other day, was that the amount of people that put their politics in their Twitter profile is shooting through the roof. So your politics is become part of your identity, and you're fighting in a team. You know, your team that, your team blue, the other one's team red, and you're just in a punch up. And it's not debate, is it? It's not political debate. And I think it's that sort of thing that's pushed me away from from attaching myself to anything politically or team wise. Just, I don't know, I just see it tribal. I just see it not something I want to be part of. I understand it as human trait and human nature, but it's not something that I want to be part of, because I think once you're sold on a way of thinking, you're not open minded. And I see it all the time. I see it on the BBC, or news or newspapers. There's an acceptable narrative, and if a story happens that fits that narrative, they'll run with it and they will blow it up and they will give it a higher level of exposure than it deserves. Yet when 10 stories come that push against that narrative, it's kind of ignored. So then the public are left thinking that this is the world that they want to sell you is the world you're in. But I don't necessarily think that is a real view of the world that we live in. And it's hard to know, especially when we're locked in, it's hard to know what world we live in. Like you said last summer, that after the George Floyd stuff, when online it was all getting a bit much, everyone was arguing and falling out, and I started to get to me, and you said you just need to get out of the house and go for a walk, and then you go for a walk, and then all of a sudden you're saying hello to strangers, and you think, yeah, that's the real world. You know, most people are all right.
But
on that story, do you want to talk about the other big story from last week, that murder of that lady, that Sarah Everard, was it?
But that's the thing, isn't it? That's part of the problem, I think, is that there's... I'd say the two biggest stories in the last couple of weeks, I mean, there's a few of them. We're going to talk about the culture wars and whether the culture wars exist or not, and so many people saying that they don't, and it's all nonsense, and it's like, well, no, I can make a list of fucking, like, one story a day, you know?
Yeah.
Of course it exists. But I'd say the two biggest stories in the last couple of weeks, Meghan and Harry's interview with Oprah, and Sarah Everard, the girl who went jogging in South London and got murdered.
Mm.
And that was by a young girl in her 30s. Turned out to be a policeman, didn't it? Possibly.
Who's been arrested and charged for murdering her, yeah.
Yeah. But again, it's like, well, it's weird. We've kind of created this environment where, as like, kind of Piers Morgan found out, I suppose, you're like, as someone not of that specific sex or gender, it's becoming more and more difficult to have, like, vocalise your views on subjects.
Yeah. Well, especially if you've got a nuanced opinion. Because it's as if people don't want a nuanced opinion that you... But what side are you on? All right, okay, yeah, but there's a lot of hot air, but what team are you on? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, I'm not on a team, am I? It's a complex issue, as everything. Someone said to me about Facebook, that, you know, one of the reasons why I come off it is that... Because all I ever said is saying, well, it's complex. You know, there's this that needs to be taken into consideration and that. And it was like, someone said, yeah, but you go on too much. And it's like, okay, well, what do you want me to be, one side or the other? But I'm not on one side or the other. To me, the beauty is in the complex and trying to figure it out, you know. Not that we're saying that the murder of a woman is complex. Of course we're not. You know, it's a terrible thing. But I think what's interesting about that story is how it's become instantly politicised. Instantly. And every big story becomes instantly politicised, where people jump in to try and work out how we're going to use it to further our argument. How can we change that into ammunition that we can use in our battle? And I think that is what the culture war is to me. Because so many people have jumped on this. You know, you saw it. I mean, what I think the police cocked up. Look, this is where my nuance comes in. All of a sudden now, a woman has murdered terribly, right? And it was weird because I was working that night and I got a job to Peckham. So I would have come through at exactly that time. I would have come through Brixton and Clapham to get home. So I remember reading it a couple of days later, thinking, I was through there. You know, but you drive, you're not looking, the people walk down the street at 10 a penny in London, so you're not going to notice. But, and then the police started to put calls out to cab drivers and, you know, in newspapers and stuff. And it was a terrible shock when it came. But it was like a Me Too moment. And I'm all for it, great. But I wondered why that Me Too moment doesn't come when other big issues happen. You know, could it be because of lockdown? But, you know, why wasn't there that? I think it's fair to ask why there is such a big difference in willing to talk about that than there was the 20 years of grooming of young girls around the country. You know, and you know, when people did want to talk about that of certain political parties, they were penalised. They lost their place on the front bench, as Sarah Champion found out.
Well, that was like the first time. So it came out about a week and a half ago, didn't it? And the first time I saw it, she just gone missing. They hadn't found the body. They hadn't arrested anyone for it, and it was on the front page of the BBC as a big headline. And strangely enough, my first thought was, and I've thought this for years, I find it strange that they focus on specific stories. And look, don't get me wrong, of course, it's appalling, it's tragic, horrible, but in a weird way, one of my first thoughts was, well, how come that gets a headline, a girl's gone missing? Because at the time, obviously, we didn't know that she'd been murdered. And of course, what's happened afterwards is it's every right to be a major headline story. I can't remember the last time a policeman ever murdered anyone. So it's, of course, it's one of the
It was a big story before that came out, wasn't it? I mean, the policeman thing made it bigger, but it was big anyway.
Of the BBC, it was one of the headlines on the BBC, and I thought, well, I would presume that girls go missing all the time. And then when I listened to that podcast that you sent me of the woman who organised the vigil. She mentioned it herself, that she understands, because she's kind of middle-class white woman, it could have been her, so that story meant more to her.
Yeah.
And I was kind of cynically thinking that, right from the moment I first saw that picture. Facebook, like six or seven pictures of black kids all in West London that have gone disappeared from the face of the earth since the start of the year. And so why do we pick up on certain stories? So that was interesting to me.
Yeah, sorry, I think I lost.
Maybe that's part of it.
I lost you for.
Maybe that goes back to the whole kind of grooming scandal. Is that okay? They're all a bit like lower class rough girls, and they don't see themselves in it.
The media classes,
the people who write about this stuff, don't see themselves. Could have been me. Could have been the sister.
I think that's right, and I think that's fair. And listen, and I'm not saying for. I'm glad there's been a stink about it. I'm glad. You know, a lot of people that I know are saying, well, and I have sympathy with this argument. All these different rules that you can bring in aren't going to stop a psychopath. Because I don't think culture creates psychopaths. I think that level of psychopathness, I'm sure that's not a word, but psychopathy or whatever. But that level, I don't think you're going to do that by changing the culture. But there is a bigger story here. And the bigger story is, in general, how some men look at women. And I think that is a really valid conversation to be had. I mean, I'm a keen runner, and there was a good friend of mine who also loved running, and I used to run down the canal, and I mentioned it to her that the canal was nice. She said, I never run down the canal, and I asked why. And she said, because I just don't like going running in places where there aren't many people about. And it just never occurred to me, and that was at the age of 48, you know what I mean? When she told me that, and I said that had never occurred to me. And and then you'd start listening to some of the stories. Our sister, I think it's kind of strange, I don't think my wife has had much hassle. She's worked in central London all her life. I don't think she's had much trouble. But our sister, when she came down to London, she did have trouble quite a lot early on, you know, on the
track. Your wife had that one fella who used to stalk her on the underground, didn't he?
Oh, that was me, yeah. Well, that's how I met my wife. But that's even a bigger point, isn't it? Because if we're going to create an environment where people are scared to approach people because it's kind of creepy, I did meet my wife on the train. I used to see her on the same train. So, yeah, I did try and get eye to eye. You know, it was built up over many journeys. But, well, maybe that might not have happened today. But Yeah, our sister, I'm sure our sister got flashed a couple of times in her first few weeks. Was this what it's like down in the Big Smoke when she first came down to London? But I'm convinced that that might have something to do with an air of confidence, you know, because I think people show a lack of confidence, maybe. So she might have attracted that type of creep. Whereas once she'd been down here for not a long period of time, but it certainly became less. But that's no justification, is it? You don't want that. Like that woman said on the podcast, get an unfair, and this has happened to my wife, is that you get blokes trying to chat her up while she's out jogging. Do you know what I mean? She's got the bloody headphones in. Why would you? Do you know what makes you think that's okay? You know, in the olden, you know, back in the day, I remember being totally embarrassed when someone I was in a car with thought it would be funny to shout out the window about the size of a woman's bum while she's walking down the street. I was mortified, and I said, I just didn't know what to say. I was speechless by it. I was so embarrassed. But some blokes find it funny. Do you know what I mean? Some blokes, you know what it's like? That's what I always try and say to my son. The biggest fear that I've got is him trying to impress his mates by doing something stupid. It's not mistreatment of girls, you know. Though I have had that conversation with him. But other things, like I knew somebody jumped off a villa roof once into a pool in a party, thinking he's going to impress people with his craziness, end up paralyzed for the rest of his life. So that's what I mean by that. You know, I always sense that danger when it comes to blokes, because they just want, you know, once they get to a certain age, they want to impress people, and they can often misjudge how to do that. So I think if we can have a conversation about men's attitude to women, then that's brilliant, because I've got a wife and I've got a daughter as well. I don't think that's necessary for me to be able to empathise with that, but I think we
Yeah,
can
no,
have that
that's
conversation.
the bonus has come out of the story, hasn't it? Because it needed to happen. When you hear stories about, like, I don't know, 80%, 90% of women have had, like, some form of abuse or other. It's all a bit, it's like quite a big spectrum, isn't it? You know, from getting, like, looked at in the wrong way on the street to, like, getting like sexually abused. But it's great that the conversation's out there. I mean, I remember when I used to be at work years ago, I was surrounded by a group of blokes, and, you know, typical blokes from all over the world, and just a couple of them were really, like, really heavy with women, you know, like. Just not even shy about staring at women. In the workplace, and so I purposely not look at beautiful women to try and level the balance. So these poor girls didn't think that every bloke was a lunatic staring at them.
Yeah,
because it was just so extreme but from some of the people. But Zach, going back to what you were saying about the fella just, like, shouting that stuff out the window. And you hear stories about, like, 80-90% of women getting abused, and it's almost like, bloody hell, 80-90% of blokes are abusing women. It's not that, is it? It's
no.
A small percentage of blokes are doing most of the, like,
yeah.
Stupid.
Well,
I'm
I was
going around doing it 10, 20 times a day.
Yeah. Well, it's the same with that sexual, like, rape and things like that. It's often a small proportion of men doing a disproportionate amount of offences. But I remember a few years ago, it must have been like springtime, so it would have been a day like today, but it was a lovely sunny day, and I was out on a run, and it was daytime, so it would have been about lunchtime. And I think I was catching up with this lady who had a bit of, you know, a bounce in her stride, and she had long curly hair that was bouncing as she walked. And on the opposite side of the road, there was a bloke in a car, and he shouted out, in not word for word, but in a way of, "Oh, madam, you're so beautiful, please, will you marry me one day?" Yeah. So he did it in a totally polite way. He did it with a smile on his face. She smiled back. There was a postman delivering something, and he looks at me and he smiled. And there was three blokes in this dynamic: me, the postman, the man who said it, and one woman. Look, it was on us in a street, not quite a high street, but it was off the high street. And everyone was quite far apart, you know, everyone was about 20 feet apart. And we all smiled on a lovely spring day. And it was quite a nice moment. And it would be a shame to distance everybody from each other in that sense. But on the other side of the coin, that might have worked in that instance, but to a different woman, that might have brought on a totally different connotation. If a different woman who suffered trauma or different, or had bad interactions with men in the past, that could have been a totally different dynamic. And then you throw in, well, that could have been at night. And at night, that would have been a different dynamic. Or if that were three blokes on their own and one woman, and the three blokes knew each other, then that's a different dynamic. So it's really complicated, isn't it? It's really complicated. Yeah.
It's the nuance of it, isn't it? I mean, it's like with yourself. I mean, me, I could do exactly the same thing to exactly the same girl, 20 years apart.
Yeah.
And at one point, she thinks it's kind of cute and nice, and another time in midlife, yeah, it's like pervy and weird.
Yeah. No.
Because suddenly I've got a bit less hair and a bit more stubble and a bit more of a paunch, and yeah, you know, it's like, and it's like anything, isn't it? Like that whole kind of, like, no, I think we've spoken about it before, like a lot of them rock stars and film stars. I mean, if Brad Pitt comes up to you and does something that Joe Bloggs from the council estate does in exactly the same afternoon,
yeah,
you're going to think about two different interactions in two totally different ways, isn't it?
Coleman Hughes, just a quick aside, because it's slightly different, but Coleman Hughes, someone we both like, is a really young black commentator in America, and he's really bright. I think he's going to be a star of the future. But he was talking about an experiment that was done, which was that they took a bit of a Martin Luther King speech where he said that white supremacy is evil, but so is black supremacy, so is Asian supremacy, so is all types of supremacies. We need to be colorblind and treat everybody the same. And he said that when that speech was read out to a group of college students and they were told that it was Martin Luther King who said it, there was an over 50% of the group listened to it, thought it was, looked at it positively. But when they was told that it came out of Donald Trump's mouth, only 3% looked at it positively, but they were exactly the same words. So you're right, you know, it is the context of at the time, and that's why it is complex, isn't it? And that's why it's complex. So I don't know. I mean, what I found really interesting about that whole story, because I think what we've spoken about there, I don't think is controversial. I think where it became controversial is where they wanted to do where they wanted to light candles. What was it? What's that called?
A vigil.
On a Saturday night, but because the police have been given new powers to stop protests and that sort of groups because of COVID, there was the women wanted to go and pay their respects, and the police didn't want them to do it. And I think the police had cocked up because there was an opportunity to work with the people. And then all of a sudden, Saturday night, all these clips started to come out, and it turned ugly, didn't it? It really did turn ugly. But you listen to the police's argument and you listen to the women's argument. I mean, that, look, here's where I get a bit cynical, because first of all, I was looking at, I don't know where it started, but where it got political, I followed a lot of women that were commentating from there at the time. I think that come a certain time of night, that it went from a vigil to a protest. And that might have been because of the police, but apparently people were trying to get up on the bandstand and start making speeches, which they weren't allowed to do. And then it seemed to have been loads of other groups got involved, because there was one bloke with a Palestinian flag. Apparently Piers Corbyn's crowd, the anti-mask, anti-vax crowd, turned up as well. There was also a group called Sisters... I can't remember, it was mentioned on that podcast, Sisters of, I can't remember, of Equality or something like that. But they're a certain strain of feminism that is anti-TERF, you know. TERF stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. So they're the traditional old-style Julie Burchill type feminists who believe women are women and don't believe that men can say they're a woman and then go into shelters and prisons and stuff like that. So they're trying to be protective due to the rise of transgenderism. But this other group that got involved are anti them, because they were a couple of years ago there was a thing at Speaker's Corner where a trans woman, so it was a man who identifies as a woman, punched a 65-year-old feminist in the face. So that crowd are part of that person, you know, was supportive of him. They're anti-turf, so they're happy to see sort of like old-style feminists, 65-year-olds get punched in the face. So they were there. There were plenty of people there with balaclavas, and that was my point. It's like every
time... and there was the all cops are bastards sign, wasn't there?
All cops are bastards, ACAB and stuff like that. And the sad thing is, it's like Extinction Rebellion and all those things, even Black Lives Matter to a certain extent. There are certain, you understand why they start, and you have an element of sympathy with what their core message is. But then you realise that there are loads of other things that come with it, and you've got to accept it all, otherwise you're an outsider. And I've had this discussion with people. I said, look, I'm 85, I'm 65-85% on board with what you want. I'm just not on board with this stuff. And that's not good enough for people. So that makes me, and I'm off it. I know that if I get involved in these conversations, I know inevitably what I will be accused of being. I know it before I start, even though I'm 80% in agreement. I've always, when it comes to feminism, if what you're talking about feminism is equality of opportunity, I'm a feminist. But if your style of feminism is to say that every problem we've got is due to men and the patriarchy and we've got to take power from them and do we got to replace them, then that's where you kind of lose me. And it's the same with a lot of these groups. Extinction Rebellion, I want to try and save the planet and species and stuff like that. But if you start trying to demonise everything we do, you want to talk about nuclear, shut them down, you've got to... And then you've got the refugees, welcome, placards, Extinction Rebellion and all sorts of stuff. And you start thinking, well, hold on, I'm not saying that I'm not welcoming to refugees, but it comes as a big package. And I'm not interested... And I know who you are. I know what you are. You're far left that want basically to rip out everything we've got and replace it with what you've got to offer. And that's something that I'm not on board with. So it's sad because these instantly, less than a week after finding the body, this is what it became.
Yeah.
And I listened.
But it's a matter, and that's a problem. It's one of the biggest problems with that type of protest movement. They so quickly descend into that, don't they? Mm. I was listening to that Martyr Mate podcast. It's a history of Jim Jones. Jonestown's fascinating. I'll tell you, the more I listen to stuff about the 60s in America, the more mental I guess it was. And he goes really quite deep into the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement and kind of all the offshoots of that. And he's talking about kind of by the 70s, it had all fizzled out because it had just got so extreme and like most of the big leaders had been had murdered people or got into drug dealing or like the murder of cops, and they ended up in prison or they ended up exiled in various kind of hard socialist countries. But what he said was that the movement had become so kind of extreme radicalized that by the end of it, they virtually stopped talking about race in America for like 20 years.
Mm.
And it wasn't until just after Obama that recently that conversation was felt to be able to be had again.
Mm.
Because the only big event between the civil rights movement and I suppose kind of the last 10 years were the riots in LA,
mm.
and they weren't viewed as good in any way by the general public.
Remember? Yeah,
and it's interesting that they've gone so extreme, and that's the problem with a lot of these protest movements. They start off from an absolutely great place, but you've got to be so careful not to kind of fall down that slippery slope, haven't you?
Well, what was that saying? There was a saying. I've got it. I remember. I wanted it prepared, and then you know what it's like. I think I remember that saying, and then all of a sudden, all of a sudden your phone's taken up with so many bloody messages. What was it? Every good movement starts off. Every civil rights movement. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. And it's true, because in a sense, if your identity is based on that fight, what happens when that fight's over? You don't give it up. you know, you start creating things that aren't there or exaggerating things that aren't there. Andrew Sullivan talks about it with the gay thing, where when they 20 years ago they were fighting for equality, marriage. I don't even think marriage was on the books. They wanted equality. I think they wanted same-sex marriage and stuff like that. He said we got everything we wanted. However, now we still have to exaggerate how bad people have got it, because so people can still feel relevant. But yeah, I think, and this is where I think we're going wrong, especially in universities, places of education in America, and it's creeping over here, but I think we're much saner than America. But I think that the reason why freedom of speech is so important, and it's not a right-wing thing, as they're trying to say, is that it's a counter to stupid ideas. So we've now got platforms so everybody can put their ideas out there, but we need to be open about those ideas being challenged. And when I was quite vocal on Facebook, I never, ever got cross when people pulled me up or challenged me, because my view was that I'm putting my ideas out there and I can't expect them not to be challenged. But we're now creating an environment where you're not allowed... there is this cancel culture coming into it, and I hate saying these kind of phrases because they could be so overused, but what else can we say use to describe it? So what happens is that there is such a price to pay for countering what the consensus is that people just shut up, because there's too much of a risk. You know, there is a risk. Me and you talking like this, there is an element of risk. And there's no gain for us, apart from it being a bit of a hobby. We don't make money out of it, but there is an element of risk. So it puts a lot of people off. And if people can't argue coherently, they just think, why bother? But that means that ideas are going unchallenged. And as they go unchallenged, they get crazier and crazier, because it's the challenge that should... get rid of the stupid parts to it. So that's why I'm, in a way, I'm quite confident that they've created such a hostile environment that the ideas are getting crazier and crazier. And because they're not getting challenged, the people that hold these crazy ideas are getting more and more confident. So as they get more and more confident, they're putting it out to the world. But as there's normal people see it, I just think this is just batshit crazy. So in a way, I'm quite confident that will change things. I mean, one of the interesting stories, the one I saw, was that Winston Marshall from Mumford and Sons.
Oh, yeah.
That was an interesting story to that, wasn't it? Because in this whole Antifa stuff, that there was Andy Ngo, who is an American journalist, and he says he's right-leaning. Yeah, he's Vietnamese, so that he ran from communism, so his parents were anti-communist, so he's kind of like a lot of these people that have left, like Cubans, a lot of Cubans are pretty right-wing as well, aren't they? So a lot of people that left communist environments, you know, see it for what it is, and many say that they see echoes of it creeping in, especially into America. And Antifa are anti-fascist group, they call themselves anti-fascist. However... you know, he's been attacked by him, hasn't he? Hit on the head with a concrete block or whatever, had concussion. And there's so many clips of him being, you know, verbally abused and physically abused while he's covering their bad behaviour. And it's kind of weird, because when Trump was in, he'd say something about the press, you know, and I mean, the people and all that, and everyone would go mad. Yet when you've got journalists being attacked by people who are on their side, they're pretty silent. And it sticks in my... Because I just don't believe that anyone...
Well, yeah, well, that was... Sorry, just to jump in. I was listening to a podcast a few months back, and that was someone pointed out that he did a little bit of a tour of Portland to see what it was like, because he'd heard so much about it pre the election. And after, kind of during the summer, they'd had like... Hadn't they had like more than 100 nights of these attacks on the Capitol, the courthouse building, by Antifa in like central downtown Portland? But what he said was most concerning to him. He said, as I walked around Portland, central Portland, I saw posters up on like little leaflets stuck up onto a lamppost and stuff saying, "Kill Andy Ngo." So they'd obviously been signed off by Antifa or whatever. But they were policy Antifa leaflets that had just been stuck up on walls for days, and that was fine.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to call for the murder of journalists.
Yeah.
As long as it fits your agenda.
Yeah. And, you know, there were so many clips of policemen during the summer of black people up at fences talking to black policemen, trying to interact and communicate. But then you'd get a white Antifa person say, why are you talking to this person? The amount of clips I've seen by white Antifa people being racist to black police officers. And also the feces, they had feces in boxes and bags, didn't they, that they were throwing at police. There was, you know, concrete in bottles or cans and stuff like that. They're kind of very militaristic in their thing, and they're growing. And I just don't believe in any political violence because I don't think it can be contained. Once you allow it on one side, it will come on the other side. And if you know anything about Weimar history and German history, Nazism didn't grow up on its own. It grew up with communism, the brown shirts and the black shirts, is it, I think. And it kind of, you know, that was going on for a few years before the Nazis were able to eradicate the communists. So I just don't believe it can be contained one way or the other. And then, but then you would get prominent voices on American TV comparing Antifa to the brave soldiers who stormed the T-Day beaches. And it just blows me away. It just blows me away. I've seen so many clips of these people attacking families, people with kids, all sorts. It's ugly, right? So maybe people on the left aren't seeing that, or they choose not to see it. I don't know. But anyway, Andy Noah has written a book about his escapades with Antifa. And a Portland bookshop that was going to sell it was boycotted, so then they wouldn't sell it in their shop. So now but you can get it online. Anyway, so this guy, Winston Marshall, who I'd never heard of, but he's a banjo player with Mumford & Sons, tweeted a couple of weeks ago, oh, great book by Andy Noe, very brave for him to do, for him to write this book, and great book, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it just lasted 2 days. Before Winston Marshall had to do a grovelling apology and has left the band.
And leave the band.
Yeah. And he's off Twitter. The only thing that's on Twitter is his letter. Here's his little message. Over the past few days, I have come to better understand the pain caused by the book I endorse. Pain caused. For starters, a book doesn't cause pain, yeah? What you want to do is monopolise your way of thinking, and you don't want that challenged. It doesn't cause pain. This is just pretend pain, yeah? So I understand that the pain caused by the book I endorse. I have offended not only a lot of people I know, but also those closest to me, including my bandmates, and for that I am truly sorry. As a result of my actions, I am taking time away from the band to examine my blind spots. For now, please know that I realise how my endorsements have the potential to be viewed as approvals of hatred, divisive behaviour. I apologise, and that was not my intention. So yeah, smashing, throwing crap at police, trying to burn down buildings. That's not hateful and divisive, but to expose it and to talk about it is hateful and divisive. And then there was we'll finish off soon because I've got to go for a dog walk. But did you hear the Bill Burr story?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I love Bill Burr. For anyone who doesn't know...
He just doesn't care, does he? He's great.
Bill Burr, I would put on a par with the best comedians out there. Definitely. He's got something on Netflix called... What's it called? What is his thing? Oh, I can't remember. I'll think about it in a minute. But he's a comedian. He's white, and he pushes back against this kind of woke stuff and political correctness really well. And he's done a couple of awards recently, hasn't he? He did one the other day because he was talking about white women.
Well, he did that. I think that wasn't that the his monologue when he went on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
About 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah.
He said to give a hand to the white women and monopolise the woke movement.
Yeah. Of shoving the black sufferers into the background, you know.
Yeah.
As if somehow they're the oppressed ones. And then he said, what did he say?
Yeah, poor me with my heated seats.
Yeah. And then he said, And he said, and let's face it, he said, yeah, I know you make out it was all us white men that were racist back in the day. He said, and of course you wanted to frequent with the black men. And, you know, on the odd occasion when you did get caught, you did cry rape, didn't he? You know, and it's quite, and it was like, ooh, it takes a deep breath.
Come over here, sit next to us and take your talking to.
So he's pretty brave. But I think he did a thing. Didn't he do something the other day? It was an award ceremony, was it? Was it the Emmys?
It was the
Emmys?
Grammys, wasn't it? It was the Grammys. I'm not sure what it was. Apparently they have a show before the show, like a pre-award show. So he shows up, he's got a suit, he's taking a piss out of the fact that he didn't realise that he wasn't even going to be televised. And he presented the award for the best Latina singer or whatever.
Yeah.
He gets a name on, kind of fumbles the name, doesn't he?
Oh, right. Yeah. So he got stick for mucking up the name, didn't he?
Well, he kind of, like, so he mucks up the name, and of course, he's kind of like, you hear giggles in the background and in the audience. And he's like, well, the feminists must be going mad now. What the fuck is this white cis male doing presenting the award for best Latina?
Latinx, yeah, best Latinx. So anyway, yeah. So then he started to be called racist and stuff, didn't he? But there is a big but. He's got a black wife, hasn't he? And that's it. I think his Paper Tiger is his thing, and it's brilliant. It's on Netflix. It was filmed at the Albert Hall, and in it he talks about his discussions about race and music, black music, white music, white artists, black music, and all that sort of stuff with his black wife, and it's a beautiful bit. It's a beautiful part of his show, and on how a white person can talk about race with his black wife. Anyway, so then, because then the defence was, hold on, he's got a black wife, yeah, so you're calling him racist. And there's this kid called Claiborne Griffin tweeted, he's white, he's got a blue check, so these aren't random people. He said, while I'm not suggesting Bill Burr is racist, a white man having a non-white wife can sometimes be a sign of racism. So you shouldn't assume someone isn't racist just because they own a minority sex servant. They may very well have one because they're racist. I mean, Bill Burr's wife just said, oh, fuck you. Do you know, to the geezer. Never met them before. How racist is that comment, and how misogynistic is that comment? But of course, racism, misogyny, if it's coming from the right end, is forgivable, yeah? So on one, and that's my issue, you know, there isn't a common set of standards. Anyway, all right, well, good to chat.
Yep, and we didn't even hit on Piers Morgan and Meghan and Harry and so much other madness. Yeah.
The Duchess of Netflix, as they call them. But yeah, that's another one. That's another complex, you know, another one you want to take sides on. But both sides have got fault, in my opinion. But maybe save that for another occasion.
Yeah.
Okay, mate. All right, Jules. Bye. Have a nice weekend. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.